Food. It's not just about filling your belly, it's a window into our past, a record of how we've lived, worked and celebrated through the ages. A new book takes a deep dive into Ireland's culinary history, from ancient feasts to modern innovations. The history of Irish food reveals so much about our changing culture, economy and way of life. The book is called Irish Food History, A Companion, published by the Royal Irish Academy. The co-editor with Dorothy Cashman is Dr. Máirtín McAnamara, chef and senior lecturer in culinary arts at Technological University Dublin, who joins me now. You're very welcome back to the History Show,
Máirtín.
Now, you write in the introduction that our food history lies in the folds and crevices, like, for example, butchery marks in the bones of animals, where we learn that the first item, apparently, on the Irish menu is perhaps something you might not expect. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, again, this is from the opening chapter by J.P. Mallory, and he says that the earliest known item on the Irish menu was venison. And, you know, his reason for saying that is that they found evidence of butchery marks on deer bones, a reindeer bone, dating back to 33,000 years ago, found in Castlepook Cave in County Cork. So, you know, we would have thought that there were people living here around 10,000 years ago, but there's evidence now with the archaeology, the earliest we have of people, of human people here, is because of that butchery mark, is 33,000 years ago, around 10,500 BCE. So that's, you know, 12,500 years ago. You also have these butchery marks on the patella or the kneecap of a brown bear found in the Alice and Gwendolyn Caves in County Clare. And it's interesting because from that idea about brown bears being here, you know, Paula Meehan in her poem, The Solace of Artemis, she talks about that in every polar bear that there's a mitochondrial DNA which stems back from a brown bear that once roamed around Ireland, you know what I mean? So it's poetic.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You cite Paula Meehan because there's a wide range of sources and experts, obviously, that you draw on in the book that give us clues as to what people were eating at any given time. And a number of those sources are, well, a number of them are in the Irish language, and a number of them are from songs and poetry.
Yeah, well, I suppose I've always been searching for any and all sources for evidence of food. You know, food history is not, it's relatively new in Ireland, in the sphere of history. Like, really, you have, you know, A.T. Lucas, who wrote, you know, in the 1960s about Ireland before the potatoes, and then you had, you know, Louis Michael Cullen, who did great work in the 1980s and started to have two chapters in his book about food and about diet. And then, you know, the great guy named Fergus Kelly, of course, has done wonderful work with your early Irish farming and your beekeeping history and all this sort of stuff. But really, it's only in the last 30 years or 20 years that we've started to take it serious, and that has become sort of an academic discipline within courses and universities and stuff like that. And it shows, you know, the importance of, because people thought we didn't have a culture, that, you know, Irish cuisine was like an oxymoron. Do you know what I mean? So there was this belief, and it was a sort of a very misguided belief. And part of that as well is that there was a great Harvard historian called Hesiah Diner, who wrote a book about migration into America. And it was really about the Irish, the Italians and the Jews in New York City particularly, and spoke about their foodways. But in her book, she said that the Irish seldom, if ever, mentioned food in their songs or poetry or literature. And when they did, they never spoke about it in any discerning way. And straight away, I knew that was wrong, because I'd grown up with songs and stories, but also not just in the English language, but also in the Irish language, since my father's from Connemara and we grew up with that rich Shannos tradition. And sure, Mór de War, you know, Siachurach na Fati Mór Dashkelekit Tali Home, you know, she's the one who'd put the big potatoes aside beside the fireplace for me. You know what I mean? Like, it was a sign of endearment, you know what I mean? And I was familiar also with the likes of, you know, Raftery's poetry, you know, Kiledon and Banisher and Slihan War and all of these wonderful things. And also with there's probably the most amazing poem or satire or document of all is called Aisling MacCunglane from the 12th century, which basically, it's the first document of its type and it's been copied all over Europe later on. This is from the 12th century, basically that presents a land of milk and honey, where literally he's going across in a coracle made out of lard on a lake made out of new milk, lands at a castle, you know, made out of bread and sausages, you know, for chains around the door, etc., etc. Like, it's just a fantastic piece. And that later on becomes, in the English and the French tradition, becomes the land of Cochin, and then Schlaraffenland within the German tradition and all that. But all that basis is back here in the 12th century.
And there are clues in the language itself, you know, even in things like the Irish word for road.
Yeah, this is it. As in, you know, the idea about the cracks and the crevices is that, you know, most of this evidence is actually hidden in plain sight. Like the word bohor, you know, which was for road, comes from bow, which is the Irish for cow. And even something as simple as bohel or callin, your boy and girl, actually mean a cowboy or a cow herder, you know, and a little herder, as in callin, in being the diminutive, you know, a small herder, you know, so that we were all cowboys, Ted, as they say. You know,
and place names as well.
Place names, absolutely. Like this idea about the Clonmel, Clontarf, Capitagal, Glenageary, any of these places, you know, their real meaning are hidden unless you have the Irish language to decode them, because like Clonmel is Cluain Mala, the meadow of honey, you know, Clontarf is the meadow of the bull, Capitagal is the tillage plot of the rye, you know, and then, what was it, Glenageary is the, you know, the valley of the sheep, you know, and there's thousands more Irish place names, food-related place names, all over the place, and just hidden in plain sight, as they say.
And your own chapter in the book is 72 words for potato, which I presume is an homage to Malcolm McGann's 32 words for a field. Are there actually 72 words for potato in Irish?
There are indeed, and more, but again, it's not all direct words for a potato as such, but it's words used in for either groupings of potatoes, for different methods of producing potatoes, like in the production and in the harvesting of potatoes, etc., etc. So, and there was like, within that, there was a triad in the Irish language called Thurskar, Prati, Poshti, right? So Thurskar is not just seaweed. Thurskar is cast up seaweed. And then that opens your mind to understand our ancestors, when there was a big storm, and again, there were certain times of year where there were storms, you know, there's Scaravín na Guach, and there's all of these different times, you know, a Rauartha, you know, like a spring tide where the seaweed would be cast up on the shore, that the people would go down, harvest that seaweed, bring it as natural fertilizer for their fields, you know, ensure that there was good potato crop, and when there was good potato crops, there was going to be poshti children. And we can see a direct correlation from, say, 1590, when you can see the potato sort of arriving or starting to establish in Ireland. We had around 1.1 million people, up to around the 1840s, when we had something like 8.6 million people.
And there's an interesting source from the early 17th century, which you highlight, the Parliament Chlina Thomas, in which you can pinpoint when potatoes became the dominant staple food, taking over from oats, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have to thank Nicholas Williams for this, who did great work on Parliament Clan na Hamáis. And it was written in two sections and written down in Munster and Kerry. And so the first section was written around 1614 or so. And it mentions that the food of the common peoples were sruan curtke, which basically these oat cakes. And then by the second section, which was written around 50 years later on, suddenly they're eating the potati, they call them, you know what I mean? So it shows in clear evidence how the potato had taken grip and had become a food of the normal people.
Let's talk about well-fed Irish historical figures. Daniel O'Connell, who was a corpulent individual. Grace Neville writes about his correspondence, which offers some interesting insights into his eating habits.
Yeah, absolutely. The letters of Daniel O'Connell are available, open access, on the Manuscripts Commission online, and Grace has harvested from that some wonderful, you know, wonderful chapter about his eating and drinking traditions and patterns and all that sort of stuff. And there's wonderful feasts, like there's the most, you know, succulent descriptions of the food he was eating down in Ivrahoch and having sent to him when he was up in Dublin or even in London, and also wonderful wines and that. But also you know, his anxieties about, you know, getting too fat. He was writing to Mary, his wife, saying, "I'm getting corpulent, I'm getting fat," and all this sort of stuff. And she says, "I love you as you are, don't be losing any weight," and all this sort of stuff. And even he speaks about, you know, doing his Lenten fast, but some of his Lenten fast doesn't sound too hard because he's eating fish all right, but it's the best of turbot, and he's eating the best of wine and burgundy stuff to go with it, you know.
And the book is also peppered with poems describing incredible feasts. I mean, you've already talked about Antonio Raffaele. There's one in particular you wanted to highlight, the Irish Jubilee. Tell us about the Irish Jubilee and what the basis of that poem is.
Yeah, the Irish Jubilee, I heard there was an organisation called, they're still going, Seanosh Cuisliffe, but my father was involved in setting it up with a number of others years ago. But I remember being at a Sunday night session in Hughes's pub, and one of the Gaelic singers sang the Irish Jubilee, and the first time I heard it, and I says, I have to learn that because it's so rich with food. And I found Barry Gleason had it recorded on Pats Across the Ocean. So I learned the words, and I learned, and I've been performing it regularly since. But it goes on for around 15 minutes, so we won't do that. And I won't subject your listeners to that. But when I traced the history of it, it's about an Irish-American senator called Doherty who was elected to the Senate. And the whole thing was that, you know, was it, they made me their senator to show them me gratitude. We'll have the finest supper ever given in this latitude. So he sends out invitations and everyone comes, and then they all sit down, and finally the food is laid out on the tables, you know. And it goes, he says, "Oh, we ate oatmeal till we could hardly stir about. Ketchup and hurry up, sweet kraut and sauerkraut. Dressed beef and naked beef and beef at all its trousers on. Soda crackers, firecrackers, Cheshire cheese with breeches on. Beefsteaks and mistakes were down upon the bill of fare. There was roast ribs and spare ribs and ribs that we couldn't spare. Oh, reindeer and snow deer and dear me and antelope. And the women ate so much melon, the men said they can't elope." So you can see how
the punometer has been going, and I think we registered at least a dozen in those. It's only not even two verses.
Not at all.
Your co-editor, Dorothy Cashman, writes about perhaps the most influential Irish cookbook. Tell us about Cookery Notes.
Cookery Notes, what Dorothy has done, Dorothy's a brilliant detective, do you know, and there was a cookbook, it has to be the most widely published cookbook ever in Ireland, because it was basically for sale for around 70 years, and it was reprinted so often, but it was published originally by the Department of Agricultural and Technical Instruction. But one of the things that really, I suppose, irked Dorothy was that there was no evidence of who wrote it. And again, through archival research, and particularly with the Department of Agriculture, a librarian, Dorothy discovered that the author of this amazing cookbook, Cookery Notes, was actually Marion Laird. And Marion Laird was an instructress in the Munster Institute in Cork from June 1903 to August 1925. And effectively what Dorothy discovered is that her authorship was effectively anonymised by the department on payment of a gratuity for her work. Now, Dorothy goes on in her wonderful chapter to actually track down other authors of various cookbooks, because Dorothy's original PhD was on sort of culinary manuscripts, and she realised that actually cookbooks as we know them, printed cookbooks, didn't really appear in Ireland until post-famine. And really, there's a glut of them after independence in 22 and later on around the time of the Second World War or such. But she's identified wonderful writers. And strange, also, there's two instructresses that she found. You know, these are people who were involved with the domestic economy, which was something that was happening from around the 1890s onwards, and these schools of cookery. But she found that two particular instructresses, you know, illustrate the tensions of the time, Nellie Gifford and Elizabeth Bloxham, both from unionist backgrounds and both actively involved in the struggle for independence. You know, so these were redoubtable women who have not been accorded the standing or recognition that they deserve in the historiography of Irish cookbooks. And, you know, this is an omission that Dorothy has put right in her wonderful chapter.
In a chapter by Ian Miller, Hunger and Starvation in Modern Ireland, there's an example of how no family was ever that far away from hunger. He tells the story of the Sullivan family.
Absolutely. When this chapter came into us as editors, like it really bowled us over, because the historiography we've been taught was people dying of hunger, that that's something that happened in the 1840s and 1850s, but, you know, particularly post-independence, that it was something we had to worry about anymore. And here we have, I think it's around 1826 or 27, you have the Sullivan family down in Cork, who at one stage were middle class and actually had a decent enough farm, but they used to sell their goods to the British Navy. And suddenly, post-independence, that was gone. They found themselves sort of down on their luck, and they were actually starving. They went looking for relief, but because they had a farm as such, they were deemed to be not be poor enough. And they went home, and they went home and starved and died. You know, shocking stuff. But there's other examples as well, given in Dublin, given down in Roscommon, etc., at different stages during the 20th century, of people found dead of starvation in their small homes, whether they were tenements in Dublin or whether they were in small little country homes.
And just to return to the potatoes, strangely, it appears that there's actually a deterioration in the Irish diet after the famine, because, well, it's related, I suppose, to the fear of over-reliance on the potato. Diet changes, but it doesn't change really for the better.
No, and again, you know, Dr. Miller has done a lot of work on this in the past. He has clearly found that the post-famine diet in Ireland was far worse, because when we were eating potatoes and when we were eating oats and milk and butter and, you know, a bit of herring and a bit of maybe bacon or whatever, you know, it was quite a balanced diet. And actually, the evidence shows that the British politicians thought the Irish men were the strongest and Irish women were the most beautiful, you know, at this stage. But come post-industrial revolution, when people start moving into cities, and again, with factories and all that sort of stuff, there was a big push towards tea and sugar and bread and spread, as in jams and things like Marmite or that sort of stuff. You know, the Bovril's or meat compote sort of thing that would be spread on bread. And that diet, it kept the working classes going, but was far inferior to what they used to eat when they were eating the porridges for breakfast and when they were eating the potatoes, and that which was nearly a perfect diet.
A world away from potatoes, bread and tea is one of the chapters. It's a study by Elaine Mahan. Diplomatic dining.
Yeah. Elaine was a student of mine in Cahill Brewer Street years ago. And again, she did her undergrad thesis first on looking at diplomatic dining. She was inspired by a paper that she saw by Michael Kennedy in the Royal Irish Academy, who edits the foreign affairs stuff, yeah. You know, and the whole idea about Sean McBride and these guys like actually dining for Ireland over in London and Paris and sending bills back to Michael Collins and asking Michael Collins to send him money. So that inspired her to actually do her PhD on how the Irish state developed diplomatic dining post-independence. And in this particular chapter, she's a full book on the subject coming out with Peter Lang next year. But in this chapter, she looked just really at Áras an Uachtaráin from 1922 to 1940 as such, or she looked at how the thing developed up until the Second World War. And it's fascinating, because originally with the new state, diplomatic dining would happen in big hotels first, places like the Shelburne or the Metropole. And gradually then, when the forecourts were rebuilt and suddenly Dublin Castle was available again, that was used for the first time with the Eucharistic Congress in 1932 and later on then for visiting dignitaries. And then there was, Dougla Síochána would have garden parties and small dinners up in the Áras. And unfortunately, you know, Dougla Síochána got quite ill, but he had these great plans to actually hold dinners to bring people who had been on different sides of the Civil War together, you know, to try and create unity again and build up through food, because food is such a powerful tool. As they say, the soft power of food, it's wonderful.
Now, food history provides amazing sources for social history. Is it becoming more popular?
It's becoming so much more popular. I've been going for over 25 years now, I think, to the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery. That started originally in 1981 or so. And so this is happening. People from all over the world come to that. In 2012, we set up the Dublin Gastronomy Symposium as a biennial event. And again, it's been going from success to success. And again, this is our eighth year running the Masters in Gastronomy and Food Studies in TU Dublin as well. And a lot of the students there do their master's thesis on food history. I had a student last year who did her thesis on the history of coddle, Dublin coddle, you know what I mean? And again, getting back to Paula Meehan, Paula Meehan's great-grandmother was one of the last madams in the old De Monto, you know, what became Foley Street, the Montgomery Street, the old Monto. And Paula had her recipe for cuddle, and all the family used to get together on the Sunday morning and round the big pot of cuddle, and there was lungs and all in there, as in the lights, you know what I mean? And seemingly they used to go brown with boiling, Paula was telling us, you know. So everything, you know, history is hidden in plain sight. Something very simple. I'm always like, you know, just constantly like a magpie looking out for things. And I'm also interested in ballads and songs. Listening to the opening sort of soliloquy to MacAlpine's Fusiliers, Ronnie Drew would say, "I come from County Kerry, the land of milk and bacon. And if you think I'll eat your fish and chips, you're very much mistaken." So I'm straight away thinking, OK, this was written around mid-40s. So clearly there was no chippers in Tralee. And actually, their famous chipper in Cork, Lennox's, I believe, is closing down at the moment. And that opened in 1951, you know what I mean? So all of this, everything that happens every day is actually history, you know what I mean? But it's important to just to keep your eye open for it and to look for all and every sources to tell the story as best you can.
Well, the book, and it's a hell of a tome, it's big, it's a doorstopper, is Irish Food History, A Companion, A Gastronomic Odyssey from Hunter-Gatherers right up to Modern Irish Cooking, featuring 28 essays, and we've just touched on a few of them tonight. It's published by the Royal Irish Academy. My guest is the editor, Dr. Martine McInerney. Many thanks for joining us, Martin.
Can I say just one thing before we go, is that the book is also available open access for free through EUT Academic Press. So anyone who wants to tap into it, it's available online for free. I'm confident that anyone who actually dips into it online for free will see how beautiful it is and will want to go out and buy a copy of it, because it's so beautifully designed by Brenda Dermody and this lovely version that the Royal Irish Academy has put out.
And
thanks
a
million.
Called once again, Irish Food History, A Companion. Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Go to market.